want to hang that out?
Yeah, you want to welcome everybody?
No, I'm just going to say that I had my choice earlier.
Give her ice to speak up. Just let me make a brief introduction. I want to stay in the background.
Yeah, I know, I'm over in this room.
I don't want to make a formal introduction. I want to stay in the background, but I want to. First of all, I want to thank Rivka for hosting this, and you know, the idea is really to try to have more of these and to try to get people involved with really some of the best minds in the modern Orthodox world. And we were talking in the car, and I know it's a frustration I have that. How to get young people engaged with serious issues that are affecting, you know, people who hopefully are serious, you know, are serious modern Orthodox Jews. I have no better way to describe it. And so it's a pleasure. Rabbi Linzer is really one of the leaders, really the young talent in the modern Orthodox world. He is the Rosh Yeshiva of Chol Mei Torah. I don't know how many of you have actually even heard of it or know much about it. Maybe you've heard of it. Who's heard of the COVID program? Who knows anything really?
Oh, wow. We're making an impact. That's great.
So most of you know what it's all about. Okay, so
maybe they know more than you. You can sit with them afterwards.
Right,
that's
right. So, he gave a very interesting presentation on Tfilah this morning, very enjoyable and informative. So I'm going to let him take it over. I imagine he'll keep it informal. And I think the idea is to talk about a little bit the conflict or what happens when halacha falls short, as he put it, ethics and halacha.
Thank you.
There are some more sheets.
Oh, look at that. We even ran out of sheets. Okay. Okay. So I want to thank all of you for coming. It's, you know, it's wonderful to see young people turning out for learning Torah on a day, you know, that you're free on a Sunday, particularly when you can be doing many other things, and I really encourage you to share that dedication with others. I wanted to talk today about, as Rabbi Kelman said, about a tension that sometimes exists, some would say often exists, between halacha and ethics and values. Now, this area, this topic can be looked at from a lot of perspectives. Sometimes the question is, to what degree do independent values or independent ethics, do they have a role within the halachic system? Does Judaism endorse the idea of our sense of right and wrong and see our sort of sense of right and wrong as something which is obligatory upon us, religiously obligatory upon us? That's one aspect of it. I'm not really going to be focusing on that so much. What I'm really going to be focusing in on is more something that follows up with a theme that I spoke about earlier today. Not values coming outside of the system, but even the values from within the system. And to what degree do we perceive of our religious obligations just in terms of halacha, just in terms of the do's and don'ts, what's in Shulchan Aruch, and to what degree do we perceive of a sense of religious obligation in terms of the values of the system as well? I spoke about that a little this morning when I spoke about prayer as a ritual and as a mitzvah, and you do it because it says so in Shulchan Aruch, or you do prayer as a type of an inner experience and a compulsion to speak to God, to connect to God. But this is really a question of the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. How much is our sense of religious obligation just to do what it says and just to discharge our obligation to do the letter of the law? How much does it go beyond that to really the spirit, the ethics, the values of the system? Because I do think that often, you know, we tend to take too much of a purely halachic lens to our sense of religious obligation. For example, I sometimes find it interesting, this is maybe this in the reverse, you know, that people will speak about Jewish medical ethics. You'll hear all these lectures on Jewish medical ethics. And then when you actually go to the lecture, what the person is going to talk about is actually about what does halacha say about, like, end-of-life directives, organ donation. They're really not talking about ethics, but the reason they call it Jewish medical ethics is because you get a bigger audience than when you call it Jewish medical halacha. But there obviously is a sense to which people can connect to trying to understand the values of the system, but to what degree do we really see that operative in our lives? And I want to start by asking a simple question about the endeavor of finding the ta'amei ha-mitzvot, the reasons behind mitzvot. Now, is that a legitimate endeavor or not? I mean, we tend to often want to think, like, what's the reason for this mitzvah? Why are we doing it? But at some level, the Gemara has a reservation about that whole pursuit. If you take a look here at this first source, here's a passage from the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. It says the following. Amar Reb Yitzchak, Lama Tokim B'Rosh Hashanah. Why do we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? Now, yeah, there's like a, what's going on there? How come? Okay. Why do we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? So, if I would ask you that question, you know, I assume a lot of people would answer. Well, what would you answer? Why do you blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? Anybody? Come on, any answer. It's all right. Well, so that's one answer, but I think most people, my guess, would be more inclined to answer the type of thing you read. You know, if I don't know. When I grew up, I always had the Birnbaum Machzor. Now everybody has Art Scroll. What do you guys use in Canada for the Machzor? Art Scroll. Okay. The what?
The new generation.
I see. So anyway, the Birnbaum Machzor had 10 reasons why we blow the shofar. To remember the Akedah, to think about the future redemption, it's a wake-up call. This is the answers most people would give. But the Gemara actually, not only does it not give this answer, is offended by the question. The Gemara says, Lama Tokim, why do we blow the shofar? Rachman Amar Tokim, the Torah says to blow it. So it tries again. Okay, why do we do truas? Marian, truah, Rachman Amar Zichron truah, the Torah says to do it. The Gemara rejects the question. We don't ask for reasons. It's a mitzvah. You do it because it's a mitzvah. Now, where do you think that resistance to looking for reasons is coming from? Why is it that the Gemara might not want to explore the reasons and just say, well, we do it because the Torah says so? Yes? Right. What if you don't find a reason? Maybe we won't find one altogether. But the Gemara could have always said one. But okay. But there is a problem. Maybe we won't find one. Or even if we identify a reason, what's the danger of looking for reasons? Let's say we identify the reason. The reason is it's a wake-up call. That's why we blow the shofar. What danger is there in sort of having that discourse? Do you want to say something? I see you nodding your head. Okay. Okay. Okay, exactly. Meaning, let's say you say that this reason no longer does it for me, or let's say you say I buy into the reason, but if that's the reason, then why do I have to blow the shofar? You know, I have other ways of achieving that end result. So it becomes sort of, you lose the sense that it's absolute, that you have to do it. It's all a means to an end. The fact that it's a means to an end has two problems. One problem is the practical issue. You might not do it if you think you can satisfy that reason otherwise. That, for example, is in this next passage, the Gemara says by Shlomo. Says the following, Amar Reb Yitzchak, Mimeila lo nitgalu tamei Torah. Why did the Torah not tell its reasons for the mitzvot? Sherei shtei mikros nisgalu tamam nichshavem gadol olam. Two mitzvot, the reasons were given, and one of the great people, Shlomo, made an error. It says, lo yir b'lo nashim, don't have too many wives, lest they lead the heart astray of a king. Amar Shlomo, ani ar b'v'lo aser, won't be, it's not relevant to me. As you were saying, the reasons lose, you know, they're not applicable to me, it's not a problem. And lo and behold, it says, vayhi leid zikna Shlomo, nashav hatu levavo, his wives led him astray. V'chziv lo yar b'lo susim, don't have too many horses, you'll return people to Egypt. Amar Shlomo, ani ar b'v'lo asher, what's not relevant to me? V'chziv atetze merkava mimitzrayim, that he went to get his chariots from Egypt. So, if you have reasons, you'll feel that you can satisfy them. They're not relevant. Somebody says the reason for kashrus is because, you know, of health concerns. So we have other ways of addressing health concerns. Everything becomes relative, a means to an end, and you'll stop doing them. That's one concern for giving reasons. I want to also point out that even if you still do the mitzvos, there's another point that's problematic, and that's if you would on a theological level. Because if you say, I do it because of X, you really are saying that your primary just system of reference is not the mitzvot. Your primary system of reference is something else. Meaning, why don't you say, why do I do it? Because God said so. That's enough of a justification for me. If you say, no, I do it because it's a wake-up call, because it's good for society, because it helps in community. So somebody could ask you, well, why are those important to you? Well, you know, let's say it's because it helps society. Well, why is that important value? You might just say, I don't need to justify that. That's like an intrinsic good. I don't need to justify. So then you have something very strange. Mitzvos need to be justified. The reasons don't need to be justified, which means that your primary frame of reference is these sort of values and reasons and so on, and not the mitzvos themselves, not the fact that God commanded it. That's not enough for you. So even if you're still going to do it, it somehow means that your primary orientation, your primary justifying frame of reference is something other than the divine command, which could be seen as problematic. So this is the reason why the rabbis at one hand, the sages at one hand, were reluctant to give too much emphasis for Tamei HaMitzvot and to pursue it. Nevertheless, it clearly was something that they engaged in. Not only did they engage in, but, you know, certainly in the Rishon in the Middle Ages and up through contemporary times, the Rambam in Moed Nevuchim, Rav Hirsch, I mean, every generation, people have engaged in an exploration of Tamei HaMitzvot. So I ask you, recognizing that there are some concerns with Tamei HaMitzvot, what is the value of Tamei HaMitzvot? I mean, why do we care? What difference does it make? Why should I say the reason for blowing shofar is a wake-up call? Why not just say, I do it because the Torah says so, it's a mitzvah, that's enough for me. What is added by trying to identify the reasons for mitzvah? Yes? Okay, so that's a very good point, meaning it helps encourage me to do it. Most people aren't at the level that you can just say, do it because God says so. If you make people understand why it somehow is something that makes sense to them, they'll want to do it. So if you would, it's a type of a form of saying, do the mitzvos and you'll get yishmechem be'itam, you know, you'll get the rain, it'll be good for you. So here, you know, keep Shabbos, you know, you have challenge and there's family and there's community. So the finding reasons for mitzvot help encourage us to do it when the divine command is not enough. Excellent. Anything else? So we're more invested, meaning it motivates us to do it in the first place, and we become more invested, and it's more meaningful for us, right? Excellent. Yes. Yes. Right. Excellent, excellent. Exactly that point, that if you can, you know, the same problem that I mentioned, that it gives some other frame of reference, while at some level that's a problem, but that's also the reality that most people fundamentally start with that other frame of reference. It's not, they don't start with the fact God commanded it, I should do it. They start with the fact that you have to justify it to me, and by giving you the reasons, it helps make it understandable, gives people motivation to do it. Yes, absolutely. But can now anybody think of any other point? Let's say somebody's already doing it and they're already motivated. Now, you said connected. You're right. It definitely adds connection. I would take that one step further. Yes, go ahead.
Further inspiration.
Right, and it gives meaning to it. Right, meaning if you think about, let's take the shofar example. If I do the shofar because God said so and I listen to the shofar, does that have any impact on me other than that I did what God commanded? It doesn't have any sort of deeper religious impact. If I am clued into the idea, let's take one reason, it should be a wake-up call to do tshuva, and I know that going in, then when I hear the shofar, maybe it's going to have some of that impact on me. Maybe it's going to make me reflect and think and motivate me to do tshuva. So if we think that the mitzvos, God did not command the mitzvos arbitrarily, God actually wants something to come out of them. He does want them to be done regardless, but God also wants something to be affected by them and come out of them. The only way they're going to have that impact is if I'm clued in to what purpose they're trying to serve. So that's excellent, meaning I agree with everything that's said, that it's there, it helps us, motivate us, connects us, helps us actually fulfill the purpose of the mitzvot. And now I want to take it one step further. Can you understand how identifying reasons for mitzvot might have significance even when I'm not doing a mitzvah? How might that impact my religious life when I'm not doing a mitzvah, if I've spent time thinking about reasons for mitzvot? Any thoughts? Yeah? Exactly. Because if I try to understand not the question, what question do I ask myself when I'm doing a mitzvah? Is God trying through me to help bring about in this world? Right? That's essentially the question I'm asking. If I pursue that line of questioning, I might not always get it right, but if I pursue that line of questioning, I'm going to have a way of looking at my role in the world and what I should be striving for, even when there isn't a specific, concrete, divine command. And I mean, don't we know a lot of Jews who have such a narrow halachic perspective that they do everything halacha requires, but when halacha doesn't tell them what to do, they have no sense of, you know, of how they should live their lives, and they feel totally free to live in a way which we'd say goes against the values of the system. All they are is just halachic Jews and nothing else. And that's really a shortcoming, because if we think that God does not just want obedience, God has values, and the values inform why these mitzvahs were commanded, then we should see as our responsibility to live our lives according to that, even when the specific mitzvah is not relevant. And this is a point that Ramban makes in a number of places on the Torah. Ramban speaks about a responsibility to identify the reasons for the mitzvot and to live our lives in accordance with those reasons. We'll read the Ramban in a second, but I want to now just reflect back for a second on the problem and of the reason and how to strike that balance. The problem for the reasons is that when the reason goes away, we're going to think we don't have to do it. The value of the reasons is that we identify, we get a sense of what the reason might be, and we're going to translate that into how we live our lives. So the really, in a way, is it good to do Tameh HaMitzvot? It depends what question it's answering. If it's answering the question of why should I do it? Why should I put on tefillin? Why should I blow shofar? Why should I keep kosher? Why should I keep Shabbos? In the end, the answer has to be because God said so. Because if you find some other answer, then if the reason goes away, you'll stop doing it. So to the answer to the question of why, ultimately there has to be an answer. God said so is a sufficient reason why, because it was commanded. But if the question is not why should I do it, but what should I understand from it? How should I connect to it? What should I learn from it? How should this impact my lives? What should I understand about God's values and the Torah's values? That's the type of pursuit of Tameh HaMitzvot that is not only acceptable, but actually, I would say, religiously mandated. And now let's look at the Ramban, where he speaks about this in terms of the mitzvah of doing what is right and good and the mitzvah of kedoshim to you. And he says the following. This is the Ramban commenting on the verse of you should do what is right and good in the eyes of God. V'yasita yashar v'atov b'nei Hashem. So the Ramban says the following. Our rabbis have a beautiful explanation of this verse. Amro, they said, what does it mean to do what is right and good in the eyes of God? Zop sharav lifni mishur tadin. This is compromise and going beyond the letter of the law. What does this mean? He says the following. V'akavana b'zeh. Ki mitchila amar, God originally, the Torah originally said, shetishmor chukosav v'idosav asher tzivach. Do what God commanded. Do the mitzvos. V'atayim, now it will say, gam v'asher lo tzivcha, even what God has not commanded you. So you haven't been commanded, there's no mitzvah. Ten da'atcha la'asot ha'tov ha'yashar be'inav, ki hu ohev ha'tov ha'yashar. Do what is right and good in God's eyes, because God loves what is right and good. Live up to a certain ethical standard, even when there's no specific mitzvah that dictates. And now he spells out the reality that mitzvos don't cover the totality of our lives. Mizein yan gadol, this is a great idea, a very important principle. Lefi she'iyev shala hazkir batorah, kol hanagat hadamim shchinav, v're'av. It's impossible for the Torah to list the entire wealth of all human experiences. The kol maso matanoviti kunei yishuvam dinot kolam, all types of human interactions, all things of social benefit. The Torah cannot list all of this. But it does mention many mitzvos relating to how we live our lives. Not to be a talebearer, not to take vengeance, lo tamor al damayecha, don't stand on your brother's blood. Don't curse the deaf. Mitnei sevatakum, rise before the elderly. After it says all that, it says in a general way, so we have a lot of mitzvot about ethical behavior, interpersonal ethical behavior. But that doesn't cover everything. I mean, you know, there are stories about, the Orthodox Jew gets caught smuggling, and he says, well, you know, there's nothing in Shulchan Aruch that says he can't smuggle, right? I mean, you know, Jews love finding these legal loopholes. We train people to be such halachicists and such legalists that they're great at finding loopholes. Well, it doesn't say you can't do this. So he says, yeah, but obviously that's against the whole values of the system. So after the Torah lists all of these mitzvot, it says in a general way, she'yaseh ha'tova yashar b'chol davar, act in a righteous and upright manner in all areas. Achi kanes, but that to the extent that includes pshara, compromise, meaning don't always stand on your rights, be willing to compromise, lifnim mishur hadin, going beyond what the law requires from you. Always do it as upright. And then he gives some examples. And the last one is achi sheyikarei b'chol inyan tam v'yashar, so that you should always be called good and upright. Here he says you have to live up to the spirit of the law, not just the mitzvahs, and he gives a very interesting reason. And this is really important for people that have like this pan-halachic approach to Judaism. Halacha does not cover all areas of our lives. Halacha does not, mitzvos cannot cover all areas of our interaction. And the Torah has values, and we're supposed to live our lives not only by the laws, but by the values that the Torah is imparting. And that is part of our religious responsibility. Here, learn from the Asita Yashar V'Hatov. Now, this place, the Ramban identifies, if you would, the interpersonal, the ethics, the social values. That's not the only values that the Torah has. And there's another place where the Ramban addresses another important range of values, not necessarily ethics, but values. And that's in the mitzvah, which we're going to get up to in about a month or so in the parasha, Kedoshim to you. Be holy, maybe 2 months. You should be holy. What does holiness mean? There are very different interpretations of holiness. For Ramban, holiness means moderation and self-restraint. Okay, that's not the only interpretation. That's what it means for Ramban. What I'm interested in seeing, though, is, again, why does the Torah have to give a broad mitzvah of being holy if it gives very specific mitzvahs? Keep kosher, keep laws relating to family purity. There's a lot of mitzvahs that address moderation of appetite and self-restraint. Why does it have to say be holy? And he makes the same point. Somebody could keep technically the mitzvot and totally violate their spirit. And we have a responsibility to live up to the spirit and not just to the law. And here's what he says in the next passage. He says, Kedoshim to you. The Torah warned against forbidden sexual acts and forbidden foods. The Torah, but it permitted marital sex within marriage, eating meat and wine, as long as it's kosher, you can eat. The lustful person will find opportunity to be engulfed, you know, in sexuality, and to be a drunkard and to be a glutton, as long as it's all kosher. You know, it's all glot, so you can go ahead and gorge yourself, right? Because it's halachic, it's kosher. So he says, and the person will speak all types of profanity. The Torah never says you can't. Famous phrase of the Ramban, this person will be a degenerate within the license of the Torah. You will be fine, your loopholes, you'll do everything halachically, and you will be a totally corrupt, degenerate individual. And there's no mitzvah that says that you violate. You haven't gone against anything in Shulchan Aruch. So this is where the Torah is telling us we have a responsibility to live up to the values of all these mitzvot and not just their details. It said in a general way, we should restrain ourselves even from permissible activities. And now he spells out that this is the way the Torah works. The Torah speaks in general and in specific. He repeats himself now. Actually, this one came first. After it relates to all types of ethical, personal interaction, don't steal, don't rob, don't oppress. Amar bechlav, v'asita yashar v'atov, do what is right and good. Shiachnis baseha yosha v'ashvaya v'choli f'nimi shor tadin l'ratzon chaveirav. Always being concerned for the other. And then he says, and now, so now we've covered interpersonal, we've covered issues of appetite, and now he throws in a third area, Shabbos. Somebody technically could keep all of the 39 melachot, not break any of them, and Shabbos would feel still very much against the whole ethics of the day, the values of the day. You know, somebody could, let's say, go up to the roof and sunbathe the entire Shabbos. Okay, technically you haven't broken anything. Is that the way you keep Shabbos? Or, let's say somebody spends the entire day moving furniture in the house. So, you know, you haven't carried, it's all within the house, you haven't broken any malacha. Is that what Shabbos means? So he says, that's why the Torah, when it speaks about Shabbos, says, Asaham lachot belav, the 39 melachos are prohibited with an explicit prohibition. V'atrachim, but expenditure of energy, work, you know, labor. V'asei klali, a general asei, shenemar tishbot, you should rest. So in these three areas, the Ramban says, the Torah is telling us, you can find legal loopholes, but you have a responsibility to identify the values of the system and live up to the spirit of the system, not just the laws, because God doesn't only care about obedience. Yes, he wants us to keep the laws regardless, even if we think the reason isn't applicable. You're commanded, you have to keep halacha. But God doesn't just want obedience. The reason God commands things is not arbitrary. Ultimately, God has certain ways he wants us to live our lives. He wants values to be brought into actuality, into the world, on the social level, on the religious level. We have to identify that and see that as our responsibility, even if technically no mitzvah applies. Now, this, I think, is a really important principle, which, as I said, is, I think, often very much lost amongst, you know, Orthodox Jews. So much do we emphasize halacha that we sometimes really forget the values of the system, because we see halacha as primary. I mean, in everyday school, I don't know what it's like here in Toronto, but I know, you know, in everyday school, we have, like, you know, a weekly or sometimes a daily class in halacha, maybe it'll be Mishnah Brewer, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. You know, when do we have classes that try to talk about what are the values of the mitzvot and how do we live our lives according to those values? I think in a way the Haredi system does that better. You know, there's a lot of talk there about not just chesed, but midos, character traits. What are proper Jewish midot? Maybe they do that well here in the Mount Orthodox schools, and I know some do it in the States, but not so much. And it's not all just about Midos. It's also about other types of values, about communal values and interpersonal and religious values, and talking about that as part of our Jewish responsibility. To show you how sort of narrowly halachic some people's mindset are, I've encountered people who read this Ramban, and you know what they say to me? They say, okay, so when it comes to Shabbos, or interpersonal, or, you know, self-restraint, that's where I have to live my life according to those values, because why? The Torah gave me, what did it give me in those areas? A specific mitzvah. There's a mitzvah of self-restraint, kedoshim tiyu, a mitzvah of living an ethical life, asita yashar v'atov. But in other areas where there's no particular mitzvah, I don't have to live up to those values. There's no mitzvah that tells me to live up to the values in other areas, because everything is just about mitzvah. I'll give you an example. I mentioned medical ethics before. You know, a big issue is cloning, right? How do we feel about cloning? What does Judaism have to say about cloning? Now, some people try to bring into that discussion the idea of kilayim. You're not allowed to, you know, mix plants and, you know, or mix wool and linen. The Torah has an idea of creating, like, unusual mixtures. So they want to say, therefore, based on that idea, you know, we shouldn't be allowed to clone. All right, now, obviously that could be attacked from many perspectives. A, do we think that that's what kilayim is about? You know, do we think that kilayim really is about something, a general idea of creating mixtures? Is cloning really a mixture? It's not a mixture. It's something, it's, you know, it's a copy. It's not something new. But let's assume we actually bought into the idea, which we can obviously question, that let's say we agreed that the value of kilayim was appropriate, was analogous to the issues about cloning. Should we think that that should indicate how we should live our lives as Jews? I could still say, yeah, it might be true that it's against the Torah values, but there's no mitzvah that says I have to apply kilayim to my life. There's a mitzvah that says I have to live upright and morally, or I have to live a holy life. There's no mitzvah that says I have to apply the values of kilayim. Do we really, you know, some people have such a halachic attitude, if I can't point to a mitzvah, or I can't point to a line in the Shulchan Aruch, then it's not part of what it means to be a Jew. It's all about halacha. And I think what the Ramban is saying is, yes, the Torah did give me mitzvos here about these broad themes, but ultimately it's not about mitzvah. Ultimately it's about appreciating that part of my religious responsibility is to live according to God's values, not just to live according to halacha. Now, I'll tell you the problem. The problem is we're not familiar, used to speaking the language of obligation without turning that into a language of halacha. But I'll prove to you that we do it in other realms of our lives. Let's say I ask you about, let's put halacha aside, let's put Judaism aside. Let's say I ask you, you know, is it acceptable to steal from somebody? You know, is it ethically acceptable? Are you allowed to? So you might say no. You know, it violates my sense of right and wrong, and you might even use a language of obligation. You know, I'm obligated to be concerned about the other person, not to steal, and so on. Not without referring to halacha. I'm ethically obligated. I think we would often feel comfortable saying that. It's actually a sad commentary that halachic Jews often don't even talk about ethically obligated, because it's all still only about halachically obligated. Sometimes halacha trumps even this sort of normal sense of ethics. But I certainly think that we understand how people, hopefully even some of us, might talk about ethical obligations. Now, ethical obligations don't have the government or God or anybody telling us we have to do it. But we could still believe in a sense of obligations without a command, without law. Obligated to act in a certain way, morally obligated to act in a certain way. So what I would ask you is, can we develop a similar language about Jewish obligation that isn't halachic? Can I say, I have an obligation to live my life according to the values of the Torah? So somebody says, well, where is it? What's the mitzvah? Where does it say to do that in the Shulchan Aruch? So say, no, I'm not saying it's a halachic obligation. I'm saying it's a religious obligation. The same way I could say that I have an ethical obligation, because if I want to be an ethical individual, I see that the system obligates me to act in a certain way. If I want to be a religious individual, then I would see that the system obligates me to live my life in consonance with God's will, in consonance with God's values and the Torah's values. So I'm religiously obligated. That's what it means to be a religious individual. Think, for example, about Christians, right? They really don't have this whole sense of law. Right? That's what, you know, Jesus came to do, freed them from the law. They still speak about Christian obligation of charity and, you know, we're obligated as good Christians to do so and so. You can have a religious obligation without thinking in terms of law. You can think about what does it mean to really connect to the values of the system, to connect to God, to live up to the religious demands, not necessarily the halachic demands. And I think that that's sorely lacking amongst Orthodox Judaism. We are so halachic that even when we talk about living up to the values of the system, we often have to couch it in halachic language, and we can't just talk about that as part of a religious obligation. Yes?
Do you think that in most of the situations where you would want to see this applied, there is one clear answer to what the spirit of the halacha would
no.
be in this case?
No, I actually think that that's sometimes why we maybe have a problem with it, because, you know, we have a very well-developed system of halakha. Now, there are going to be debates. You know, there's a whole range of opinions on any halakhic matter as well. But we know more how to attack it and get to it. And we just sort of more can concretize it. You know, values is much more amorphous, and you will get a very wide range of opinions. And that's why I think in some way we're afraid of it. We're afraid of it because we can't prove it, we can't demonstrate what the values are. There's going to be wide divergences of opinion. But I don't think that that exempts us from striving to achieve it. I think that even within halacha, we don't always get halacha right, but we have to do the best we can. If we see our religious obligation to live our lives in accordance with God's will, we'll do our best to try to be honestly get to it and understand it. You know, we might be wrong, but it's better than not trying. So I agree that that's definitely a major challenge, and it's much more difficult in terms of values than in terms of halacha, which is, you know, more well-defined the process. But I would argue that it still is, that doesn't make it any less a responsibility. One could even go so far to say that maybe the very orientation of trying to live our lives according to God's will is itself all that God really asks from us. Meaning, as long as we're honestly pursuing that, even if we have very different understandings of the reasons for the mitzvot and we apply them differently, but that very orientation of bringing the way we act into the world and asking ourselves, I'm trying to do this to correspond with, you know, what God wants to achieve in the world, that may be in itself, however we interpret it, is maybe all God asks from us. But even assuming that there is some specific correct answer to that, what is God's will, and we're only going to guess at it, I still think that we have to do the best we can to strive for it. But you're absolutely right, and I want to get back to that point, that it's something that is much more fraught with difficulty than the halachic process. But clearly I don't see that as negating the importance of this, but maybe explaining why Jews have often not focused on it. You know, you do realize, by the way, that this critique goes all the way back. I mean, it goes back to when the Nevi'im were critiquing people for bringing sacrifices and focusing on the ritual and not focusing on the values. You know, I mentioned before Christianity. If you read, you know, if anybody's ever read the Gospels, I don't know if that's off limits or not. But anyway, Jesus, you know, not later Christianity, which is Paul, but Jesus was Jewish, very seriously Jewish, and he was just critiquing the rabbis for being too halachic, for being too legalist and losing sight of the values of the system. In some way, you know, it was partly a sense, one could say, of a critique of Hasidism, although that's slightly differently, or of the non-Orthodox Jewish movements, which bring up issues like Tikkun Olam and Jewish values. Now, our answer back is, yeah, but you guys are forgetting halacha. Well, that's true. But we have to recognize, you know, while, of course, halacha is central and obligatory, that doesn't mean that we should not recognize the legitimacy of those critiques and the need to say that that's not the entirety of our Jewish responsibility. Jewish responsibility goes beyond halacha, goes to living lives according to the values and trying to live up to what God wants us from us in a much broader sense. Now, what I want to, I only have 15 minutes, so not going to go into detail with the rest of the sources. I want to look at one or two sources at the end. Let me just sort of summarize it for you, and it picks up on the point that was just made. What often happens in this tension between the values of the system, and notice that I'm talking about the values from within the system. I'm not talking about some external system of values, the values of the mitzvot themselves. But the tension between that and between the fact that we're oriented just to respond to halachic obligation and not to a sense of some other obligation, it leads to an interesting tension sometimes that we find amongst the poskim when those two are not the same. And the rest of these sources discusses the issue of tzar balei chayim, of animal experimentation. Here we have an interesting story. The question that comes up for the Rishonim is, well, let me just start before that. The Talmud asks, is the principle of animal suffering, of tzar balei chayim, is that a biblical principle or not? And in the end it resolves that it is biblical, and the application is that you're allowed even to violate rabbinic restrictions, not biblical ones, rabbinic restrictions to prevent animal suffering. So So if the animal is down the well, you can save it on Shabbos if it's only a rabbinic prohibition. It actually has profound implications in Israel, because if you have a milking cow, you're allowed to milk it through a rabbinic way, because normally milking the cow on Shabbos would be biblical, but you can have a non-Jew do it, or you can do it, let's say, by a machine, because the cow would be in pain if it were not being milked. This actually is very important, because, you know, if you have a halachic dairy farm and you had to not milk it on Shabbos, you would lose 15% of your profit. So they actually, because you're allowed to break Shabbos on a rabbinic level for the sake of the animal suffering, it actually becomes very convenient. So this is, animal suffering is seen as biblical, and it allows a violation of rabbinic law. Now, here's an interesting question. What does it mean that animal suffering is biblical? There's no mitzvah in the Torah that says you must prevent the suffering of animals. So why do you think, where do you think the rabbis get the idea that animal suffering is biblical? I mean, is there something they could have inferred it from? Any ideas? You want to contribute? Yeah. Go ahead, go ahead. Everybody else is quiet. Come on, jump in. Okay. No.
He said because we have to shech the animals.
Okay, so shechita is done in a way that's very humane, excellent. And there's a lot of mitzvahs in the Torah that are about animals, sending free the mother bird and unburdening the donkey, and all of these mitzvot that might be about preventing suffering. Now, the debate in the Talmud might be exactly what was mentioned here, which is, how do we really know what the reason is? You know, maybe there are other reasons. Maybe the reason, send away the mother bird. The Ramban says it's not to prevent suffering of the animal. Can you imagine? He says, look, I mean, he doesn't say this, I'm elaborate. He says, there you are, you're taking the eggs and you're shooing away the mother, and it's flying back and trying to protect its eggs, and you're shooing it away. I mean, that's really suffering. To prevent suffering, you would kill the mother and put it out of its suffering. That's how you would prevent suffering. So in every individual mitzvah, you could debate, is this really about suffering, or is there something else? And maybe that's what the Gemara was getting at. How do we really know what the reasons for the mitzvot are? But in the end, the Gemara concludes that this is the reason, is to prevent suffering. The Torah cares about preventing suffering of animals. Now, this in itself is an amazing point, because until now I've been speaking about values and halacha and sort of operating in different spheres. What the Gemara does is an amazing thing. And to the best of my knowledge, the Gemara only does this in one other place. It identifies a value in the mitzvah, and it takes it, that value out, and makes it operative within the halachic system. And that value now will trump rabbinic law, and that value will override rabbinic law. That's amazing. Tamei ha-mitzvot actually functioning within the halachic system. To the best of my knowledge, it only occurs in one other place, and that's in the Gemara in Brachot, where it says, kavod ha-brios, human dignity issues, override rabbinic law. The exact same parameters as tzar balei chayim, not biblical law, rabbinic law. And where does the Gemara know that the Torah cares about human dignity? Because when it says you have to return a lost object, we're told that you're exempt if it's beneath your dignity to bend down and to pick it up and to run after the owner. So you see that the Torah cares about human dignity, and if that's true, it trumps rabbinic law. So this is amazing. Here's one place where values actually function within the halachic system, and the other, and tzar balei chayim and human dignity are the two areas. Now, the question is, it doesn't end there, because the Rishonim want to know, are you allowed to have animals suffer to serve human needs? Can we allow for animal suffering? Now, some might want to say, well, 1 minute, you shecht animals. Okay, but first of all, they don't really suffer. It's instantaneous. I mean, we can take animal life, but that's not exactly the same as allowing animal suffering. Well, we also use animals as beasts of burden. In the time of the Talmud, you know, you'd plow with them, you'd use your donkeys and your mules. Okay, but that's work. That's not suffering. I mean, you know, we all eventually have to go to work for life, and we might sometimes consider it suffering, but generally, there's a difference between work and actual pain and anguish. Are you allowed to cause pain and anguish to serve human needs? Now, here, the Talmud is not clear about this. Tosfos certainly says you are not. But there's one opinion out there, there's a Ramban, which isn't quoted, but there's also Trumas Hadeshen, 15th century Ashkenazic scholar, who says that we are allowed to have, for animals to suffer, to serve human needs. But he qualifies it. And why don't we start by looking at that text? We only have a few minutes, but I want to show you how these sort of things play in tension. If you jump to, it's source number 10. It starts on page 4. Oh, I was right. It's 15th century, late 14th, early 15th century. And let's start it from the beginning. We'll just read a little bit. Here's the question he was asked. Im limrot notzot lavozot chayim. Is one allowed to pluck feathers from live geese? Why would somebody want to pluck feathers from live geese? What? To make? Quill, right. To make, well, not quills. I mean, maybe that you get from birds. To make down. Okay, so that's why you want to do it. Is it like shearing sheep, or is it tzar balechaim? You shear sheep for wool, so you pluck feathers from geese for down. Well, if you want to know whether plucking feathers is like shearing sheep or not, ask yourself if you would rather, next time you get a haircut, rather have your hairs plucked individually, okay? Shearing sheep does not hurt. Plucking feathers hurts. Gam lachtoch lashon ha'ov kidei sheyidaber. Can you cut the tongue of a parrot or bird so that it could speak? Somebody once explained this to me. I don't know what it means. Maybe they thought that maybe there was some way in which it would help parrots speak. I really have no clue. The last one is interesting. Aznaim bezanav mikelev kidei liyafoto. Can you trim the ears and the tail of a dog to make it look nice? That sounds really cruel and crazy, but you know, I have two kids, and it's amazing what you find in kids' nursery rhymes. This is in a kid's nursery rhyme. Does anybody know this? Where has my little dog gone? Does anybody know this one? Where can he be? With his ears cut off and his tail cut short. Where can he be? So right there in the nursery rhyme, you've got that. They would do that. People still do this. Is this allowed? Now, this is amazing. Here you have animal suffering to serve human needs. The first case, you might say it's a genuine need. It's financial. The last two cases seem totally trivial, right? To make my French poodle look nice. Is that allowed? And listen to what he answers. He says, Nirim hadvarim, it seems to me, de any sur, mishum tzar balechayim. It's not prohibited. If you do it for your needs, the mentioned question became before about how do we understand the values of the system? People will have different interpretations. He says, all creatures were created to serve human beings. Where do you think he gets that idea? I mean, he references a Gemara, but where does that Jewish idea come from, that the creature, animals, and the world was created to serve the human beings?
Creation.
Right, the first chapter of creation. So it's all there to serve human beings. We can do anything we want to serve our own needs.